Just so everybody knows, I put everyone who isn't presenting or will talk in the next couple of minutes on mute just to keep things smooth. And for everyone who doesn't know who I am, I'm Lynn O'Connor. I am filling in for John today because he's on another very important call. So I'm just going to put that out there. And he wanted me to talk a little bit about the programs for people who are coming in, and we can distribute any information. If you're interested in anything specifically, you should be able to see my screen or at least a slide of upcoming programs that we have. Every Monday we've got exercise, every Wednesday we have yoga. Most of these are on Zoom. And if you're interested, you can email me at loconnor@ses-delco.org or John, whose information you probably have if you're here today. But if not, go ahead and contact your SES person for any additional information. And with that, I think that Farah would like to introduce the Breslins. Is that correct? Oh. We can't hear you, Farah.
No.
Okay. Lynn, can you hear me?
Yeah, you're good.
Okay. I want to welcome all of you to today's presentation. And this is almost towards the end of our fall semester. Our presenters are Robert and Dana Breslins, who really don't need much of introduction. They have been providing our program since it started 16 years ago. And have been educating older adults with different aspects of their rights. At this time, I don't know when the township buildings we have used in the past will become available, but I will let all of you know when about our spring semester and the plan we have whenever I find out myself. Also, if you have any suggestions about future topics of presentations, you can either email me or call me, and I'll do my best to accommodate that. Thank you so much, and thanks, Robert and Dana, for providing us with another informative information. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Farah.
Sure.
All right, before we begin onto the substance, I want to remind everyone that the Delaware County Elder Law Resource Guide and Handbook is available. On a nice day like today, we will have a box outside our office that anyone who wants to come over, they can pick them up or pick them up for themselves and their neighbors. As the weather becomes colder or dreary, we ask if you come, stay in the parking lot, but call the office and we'll bring a book out to you. They're invaluable. And so anyway, and they're also free. So, okay, we'll get to the substance. Today's seminar is a little bit of a potpourri, but there are some unique issues that come up with estates. And it's not the same issues for all people, but when you have one of these, you always want to know what to do or what are your possibilities. As attorneys, we're always trying to come up with good ways to handle some of these. And sometimes it's really hard to even come up with a solution. But with that, we'll start with our some of the specific issues. I do want to warn you that what we're saying, it is general information. So please be aware that, you know, one answer is not good for all people. And this is not meant to be a specific advice to you. Always consult with your own attorney.
So can we go to the next slide? And the next slide.
So for the first, which is always big, is what if you have a child or a grandchild or some beneficiary who is disabled? Is it appropriate to leave that individual any money? How do you do it? What are the ways that, you know, you might address it?
Next slide, please.
And
yeah, so the first question always is, as Dana indicated, how do you handle it? And in Pennsylvania, I think we kind of have two different ways of doing it, depending on dollar amounts. And one of them is called the Supplemental Needs Trust, which we're going to talk about first. And the second is called an ABLE account, which we'll talk about after that. So Supplemental Needs Trust, it's also known as a third-party special needs trust, is for disabled beneficiaries of any age. And I think generally we use it for people who are receiving public benefits of some sort. Example, I guess, would be Supplemental Security Income or SSI, which is for people who did not have enough working quarters or employment quarters where they paid into Social Security. And consequently, they're not entitled to general Social Security disability. But you still, if you're disabled and didn't have enough working quarters, you could be entitled to SSI or Supplemental Security Income.
Where this is so important is if, and in our case, if there is a grandchild who has a severe learning disability, has autism that is in the far end of, and you know that they're never going to be able to be independent in their life. And right now they may be receiving special ed services through their school district. But it's critical for that grandchild to be able to become eligible for SSI and those various programs. Because especially when that child turns 18 or 21, if they don't have an ability to access SSI, they can lose their Medicaid and ways to pay for the services that they need to at least either remain in the community, remain living with their parents, or perhaps they'll be living in a group home. So that's usually what I see as a big reason to help my clients with their wills to establish what I call the Supplemental Needs Trust. And that is very, very different than if a disabled person himself or herself receives money and sets up a special needs trust. We call that first party. When it's done by, you know, the grandparents or the parents, so the third party with the grandparents' money or grandparents' money after death, the type of trust is not quite as restrictive as a special needs trust, but the purpose is still the same. It supplements the public benefits, whether it be SSI or housing assistance, what have you. It's not to replace the basic support that that person is receiving from various benefit programs.
Yeah, so think of it this way. If you had a child, grandchild, or any intended beneficiary who's getting SSI, Supplemental Security Income, one of the requirements of that program is that you can't have more than $2,000 in assets. So if mom, on behalf of a child or grandchild, simply leaves an inheritance outright to that person, they may end up with more than $2,000 of assets, disqualifying them for SSI. And there's all sorts of other programs which are either income or asset-based, where you could lose benefits such as food stamps, health insurance, things of that nature. So under those circumstances, we definitely don't want to leave the money outright to them because they're going to lose those benefits. So the next question is always, well, what's a disabled child or grandchild? What is disability considered to be? And generally, the test is this what we call the Social Security Disability Test, which is inability to work in gainful employment for 12 months or more.
Yes.
For 12 months or more. So if you either haven't been able to, or it's expected you will be unable to, you may meet that Social Security test. Now, clearly it's easy when the person's getting SSI or Social Security disability of one form or another, that they've met that test. But if you haven't gotten SSI or you haven't applied for Social Security disability for one reason or another, I don't think you're necessarily barred from still meeting that test.
That's correct.
So for that type of person, I think it's expected that the individual's doctor would be able to indicate that the person is unable to become gainfully employed, that type of thing. And with that, it may be enough, even if you haven't applied for SSI or Social Security disability. So we're looking at a person, whether it's a child, grandchild, or whoever, that is a disabled. As Dan indicated next, what's important to understand is that this money is going to have to be placed into this supplemental needs trust, which means we create, when the person dies and the money's distributed to the trustee on behalf of that supplemental needs trust beneficiary, they open an investment account, a bank account, whatever, and the money flows into that. Once that's established, now we get to the issue of how can we use the money?
Well, even before that, I want to stress this trust is not separate from the will. It is a provision within the will. So it's not, you don't have to set up an account now for the trust. It is a provision several paragraphs under your will, and we call that a testamentary trust, but it's a testamentary supplemental needs trust. And if you don't know how your grandchild is going to progress, maybe he or she's 3 years old, and you're praying and hoping that with the proper rehabilitation and education, ultimately they will become self-sufficient. So you may say, I don't know if they're going to need SSI, Dana. I just don't know. We can make it as an option within the will that if your beneficiary at the time of death would need these types of benefits, then your executor can set up the trust according to the terms that are spelled out in the will.
Now, what's interesting is just because you're disabled doesn't mean we need a supplemental needs trust. Mm-hmm. So if the beneficiary is in fact receiving full Social Security disability and no public benefits, they can inherit as much money as they want. It's only a person who's receiving government benefits such as SSI and, for example, food stamps, medical insurance, things of that nature, where income and assets come into play. So always keep in mind, just because I have a disabled child doesn't mean we have to have a supplemental needs trust. Now, having said that, usage.
Well, how can the funds in the trust be used? And I mentioned earlier, it supplements the benefits available. So, for instance, it can't pay out steady money to the beneficiary, like so much each month, because that would count as income. But it can pay for things like maybe their cell phone service or going to the gym. I guess that's not as valid anymore in today's COVID world. For a therapist to come to the house that's not covered by Medicaid.
You could use it to purchase an automobile, pay for cable television, clothing, things of that nature. So there's a whole list of things that you can do with it, but there's a list of things that you can't use it for. So, for example, the money cannot be used, so the money in the supplement needs trust cannot be used for food or to pay for a mortgage or real estate taxes or rent. And so the immediate response, my thinking had always been, well, then what's the point of having this trust? You know, how's the rent going to be paid? How's the mortgage? You know, why can't we use it for this purpose? And as I understand it, and Donna should correct me, as I understand it, it's because
SSI. I'm on the workshop.
SSI is intended, the monthly income payment that one receives on SSI is intended to pay for rent. It's intended to pay for food. And it used to be that it was intended to pay for clothing, and they finally did away with that and allowed that to be used for clothing. But because this SSI money that you receive monthly is intended to pay for those services, you can't use that money to pay for those services.
Now, Bob, what you're saying is true if the benefit we're looking at is SSI.
Yes.
If, perchance, they're getting Social Security disability, they still need a supplemental needs trust because they have Medicaid and need Medicaid, then the money in the trust can be spent for housing.
Yes.
So what I'm trying to get across is we look at the benefits the person may need to obtain or already have, and that can direct how the trust will be used. You may be sitting there and say, well, I have certain concerns for my child who, yeah, they don't handle money very well, but they don't need any public benefits. Well, we would still look at setting up a trust for that child or grandchild, but have it much more flexible than the special needs trust or supplemental needs trust we're talking here. So I wanted you to know you can tailor the trust to meet your concerns you have for your beneficiary.
Okay. Having said that, assuming that's the case and we set up the trust post-death, we need to have a trustee. So we need to have named in the will a trustee to handle the funds on behalf of the disabled individual. So oftentimes when we do it, we name a trustee and we always try to name a backup in case something happens to that trustee. Now, the nice thing about this trust is let's make believe we put $100,000 into that supplemental needs trust, and eventually that beneficiary themselves, the disabled individual, dies, and there still remains $50,000 in that trust. Normally, if you've received certain types of public benefits, the balance in a trust has to be used to pay back for those benefits, but not under a supplemental needs trust. So if there's a $50,000 remaining balance, that money doesn't go to pay back the benefits received by that beneficiary. So we always want to make sure that we've named somebody who's going to get those funds if there's any remaining balance on the death of the disabled individual. Yes?
Yep, that's correct.
Yes.
As far as naming a trustee, though, that can be very difficult, especially if the beneficiary has some serious emotional, mental health issues. And, you know, if you name one child to be trustee for another child of yours, it can put a heavy burden on the trustee because they're having to say no to their sibling if it's inappropriate. So we also look at, besides persons that you have in mind that might be able to handle it, there are certain what we call corporate trustees, whether it be a bank or some of your what I call non-traditional entities like Plan of PA or Special Needs Alliance who can act as trustee. So,
yes. Okay. Yeah, so that's what we wanted to mention in terms of a supplemental needs trust. But I also said, well, there's a second way of, in some cases, doing it.
Next slide, please.
Yes, next slide, please. Okay, it's called an ABLE account. Now, every state pretty much has their version of an ABLE account.
And Pennsylvania has it.
And Pennsylvania definitely has it. And there are a couple of different requirements. Now, number one thing
as background.
Go ahead.
For up until just about 2 years ago, and it was usually, well, parents and grandparents would like to set up college savings accounts for their children or their grandchildren. And there's a couple different types. And if there was a beneficiary who was never going to go to college because of their disabilities, the parent and grandparent would be very, very frustrated because they did not have the same type of vehicle to be able to set aside some savings, have some income tax benefits to doing so. So the ABLE account is in some ways like the equivalent of a college savings account you might set up for your grandchild or your child.
But it's a little bit broader than that. Yes. But understand, one of the differences in the Supplemental Needs Trust, the disability can be at any time. Mm-hmm. Whereas under the ABLE account, the person had to be considered medically disabled before the age of 26. Mm-hmm. And it has to, and it says it has to last greater than 12 months. They have to be blind or medically determined physical or mental disability. So big thing to there is basically it had to occur before the age of 26. So that's number one. Number two, it's the funds can be used a little bit more broadly under an ABLE account than necessarily under a supplemental needs trust. So what I had said under the supplemental needs trust is you cannot use the money to pay for food, for mortgage, real estate taxes, rent, utilities, but you can under an ABLE account. So, for example, when we draft supplemental needs trusts, we always, at least I do, put a provision in there that we can put some of the funds into an ABLE account. We can allow the trustee to establish an ABLE account on behalf of the disabled individual, and we can put that funds into an ABLE account. So in a sense, we kind of get our cake and we get to eat it. We get to eat it, whatever that phraseology is, have our cake and eat it too. Because what we're doing here is we may have money in a supplemental needs trust, but if we also have money in an ABLE account, we can use the money in the ABLE account to pay rent for the individual.
Yeah, now next slide, please.
Thank you.
So, now, before we do that, I just wanted to mention, because it's not mentioned in the slides, Dana, okay. Other things that it can be used for. Mm-hmm. Dana previously mentioned education expenses. So it can be used for that purpose. Transportation expenses, including, again, for example, purchasing a car. Health expenses, such as medical insurance, support equipment, personal assistant, things of that nature. Phones, those kinds of expenses. So the good thing is the ABLE account does have a lot of different things it can be used for, and in some respects, better than a supplemental needs trust.
The biggest way is it can provide for housing, which is mm-hmm. huge,
mm-hmm.
huge.
Now, having said that, one of the differences, again, is the amounts, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
So as you look at the slide that's up in front of you now, you can only put in $15,000 per year. And that doesn't mean anybody who wants to contribute can put in $15,000. That's the maximum total contribution that can be made in any 1 year is $15,000, with one exception, that if the disabled person is also working, and a lot of disabled people work, for example, through Elwyn and places of that nature, they can also contribute an additional up to $12,490 a year. So that's one. The maximum benefit, lifetime that can be in that maximum that can be in the account is just over $511,000.
But
go ahead, Dana.
If the person is receiving SSI, then the maximum is $100,000.
So you have to be aware of that. Another nice thing about it is, assuming you had an ABLE account for John who's disabled, and John ceases to be disabled, and John has a brother or a sister who's also disabled, we can move that money into the ABLE account for the sibling. So that's a benefit that we like also. Next slide, please.
I will say, if you're interested in an ABLE account, if you go to the Pennsylvania website, and if you type in ABLE account, it's through the Department of Revenue. but it has some very good information with a lot of good detail and how to set up a Pennsylvania ABLE account.
As a matter of fact, I actually think that the Pennsylvania website on the ABLE account is one of their better websites. It answers tons of questions and clearly, concisely, and I always found it very helpful. Now, another benefit is if I, mom, want to, or dad, want to put money into the ABLE account for the disabled person, I can contribute. Again, no more than $15,000 can go into the account, but it's a tax deduction on my Pennsylvania income tax return, not on the federal, but it is on my Pennsylvania state income tax return. The other thing is the if we put it into an allowed investment account and it earns interest, that interest is not subject to income taxes federally or state, providing that the funds are used for the allowed purposes. So if I take money out for this for because I want to, or it's not used, it can be subject to income taxes. An individual can only have one ABLE account. Mom can't set one up for the child and dad set up a separate one. The child can set one up for themselves, but one account total for any disabled individual. And then you're limited to the dollar amounts in terms of that. So next slide then. Oh, one other point. One big difference. I told you under a supplemental needs trust on death, if you have a named beneficiary, it can go to that beneficiary and it's allowed. It's not subject to payback. But under an ABLE account, on death, funds can be used for funeral and burial expenses. But if there's any remaining monies, it may be subject to a state recovery in Pennsylvania.
Well, I'll do a caveat.
There you go.
The ABLE accounts in Pennsylvania do not require a payback to the Pennsylvania. However, that is more liberal than the federal requirements. So many of us think sooner or later Pennsylvania will be required to have a payback.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, the federal law says it has to be used to pay back. Pennsylvania, interestingly, took the position it did not.
Well, the way it's worded on the federal law, it's not quite required. So for once, Pennsylvania took a broader interpretation.
But it's something one needs to be aware of. Okay, moving on. Another what if. Mm-hmm. What if a deceased owned a car at the time of their death? And let's make believe that the only thing they owned at the time that would require probate is the car. Mm-hmm. Do we have to probate the person's estate to transfer the car?
And the answer to that is no. Providing there is a surviving spouse, or if there is no surviving spouse, then generally it's children and certain direct heirs. In that case, it is possible to transfer title without doing a formal probate.
The only potential requirement is that technically the debts of the decedent have to be paid. Usually what I see is that if we use a tag, an auto tag place, they want proof that the funeral has been paid. And as long as that's the case, then generally you're fine. But I've had a lot of cases over the years where dad died, mom's living, dad owned the car.
Right.
And mom's sitting there saying, I mean, I have to probate dad's estate to transfer the car that was in dad's name. The good news is no, we don't.
There is a slight bump in the road. If you cannot find title to the car, when you request the duplicate title out of Department of Motor Vehicles, on the form, it's only if there is a personal representative for the estate to ask for the title. Personal representative being the executor or administrator.
Appointed by the Register of Wills.
So that's just be careful. Don't lose the title to your car.
Yeah. Okay, next slide. Another what if. What if the deceased was due wages or salaries, employee benefits. Let's start there. Dad was working up until the time of his death, passed away suddenly. He's due his 2 weeks pay, hadn't been paid in 2 weeks. He's due his pay, or maybe some sort of reimbursement from the employee. Is mom going to have to probate the estate in order for dad to get it? And the answer is on the next slide. If it's less than $5,000, it can be paid to the spouse, if no spouse, to any child, then father or mother, then sister or brother, in that particular order. So it basically says, look, spouse first, children second, parents of the deceased next, siblings of the deceased after that. So for those wages, salary, and benefits, if it's less than $5,000, we don't have to probate.
I have found this to be really useful in the case that usually the adult son is living with mom and dad, and the son unfortunately passes away.
Mm.
And, you know, mom and dad are dealing with, you know, loss of a child. And the child, you know, usually doesn't have much by way of assets to require probate of an estate. And they're just trying to get that last week's pay and maybe some accrued vacation. And so this can be very helpful to those in that situation or any time.
Absolutely. Right? Another situation is parent dies or whatever. And the only thing they had that is what we would call probate asset. A probate asset is a solely owned asset without a beneficiary. Is they had their Wells Fargo bank account. And at the time of death, the checking account with Wells Fargo had less than $10,000 in it. Are we going to have to probate that estate in order to get that $10,000? And the answer is no. Again, if it's less than 10 grand, the order of preference being spouse, child, parents, siblings, it can be paid. Again, upon proof here of the funeral bill either having been paid or that satisfactory arrangements for payment have been made with the funeral home. So that's
and
a good one.
I will say now, this question arises in our office at least once. Well, I was going to say once a day, but at least around three times a week. And often it's just that the surviving spouse has been told this $2,000 bank account that their husband or their wife had by the bank person, you're going to need a short certificate. We can't help you.
Which, of course, means that they're wrong because,
well,
in fact, they are wrong.
A short certificate is proof that an executor was appointed. You do not need to probate an estate if the account is under $10,000. Most persons who work at the banks have not been told the correct rule. And so you don't have to fight with the individual. They're wrong. Leave and then arrange either to see the manager or talk at some point later to someone who's more experienced. I have literally given clients a copy of the law to take back to the bank.
And I've done that also.
Yeah.
So I can just give them the law and say, if you still aren't going to release it, take this and give it to your legal department for the bank and then have them contact me.
And the law says must. Not
yeah, me. Yeah, it says must.
Okay.
The next one is a personal needs account. Now, we usually only see
at
this.
At a nursing home.
Yes.
Have it.
And that's usually where we see it. If somebody's in a nursing home, usually on Medicaid.
Yeah, their $45 a month goes to their personal needs account at the nursing home.
And that, if it's not spent, builds up over time.
Mm-hmm.
And now when the person dies being on Medicaid, you have built that account up to less than $10,000. So the law is written that allows the money first to be used for burial expenses without having to appoint a personal representative. And then after burial expenses, it can be paid the balance again to spouse, child, parents, siblings, again, in that order of preference. Next slide, please. How about life insurance, Dana? We get that one a lot.
Yep. If the life insurance has a value less than $11,000, the insurance company can release it. Again, it's to the immediate next of kin. And usually the insurance company will want an affidavit certifying who the children are or the other heirs, and that all bills have been paid, and that the insurance company will be held harmless if they release the money to the person requesting.
Now, that's only going to happen if there's no named beneficiary to that life insurance policy. Right. So if there's a named beneficiary, this what we're talking about does not apply. But if there's no named beneficiary, then it does. The next one is unclaimed property.
Yeah.
And we see this unclaimed property is bank accounts that were lost. I had a bank account at a bank. I moved away. The bank had no way of contacting me. Eventually, that money is sent to the state into the unclaimed property division. Or stocks, the dividends, that type of thing. That the stock company had like an AT&T, a GE, whatever. They're trying to pay me a dividend, and they sent me a check, and I never either got it. I never cashed it because for whatever reason.
Well, there you'll see it, especially now that the revenue department has been more active in posting lists of unclaimed property. How many of you have gone or to their website to say, oh, is there anything there? And we will have people calling up saying, gee, my dad who died 30 years ago is listed as having this small whatever. Now, you may have trouble finding a death certificate, but at least you know you don't have to probate his estate to claim the $500 or whatever it is that's sitting there. So
in any event, again, unclaimed property, if it's less than $10,000, it's held by the state, can be released in the order we've been talking about without the appointment of an executor or a personal representative. So that's good. Next slide, please. Pets. Go ahead, talk about pets.
I'm smiling because I will often spend more time preparing a will for someone's pet or pets. And I know that pet is well loved, and under Pennsylvania law now, you can provide in your will or set up a living trust for funds to be set aside to care for your pets. And we just call that a pet trust. But it is recognized, and it is something for you to think about if you yourself have a pet or pets, and you want to make sure, you know, if you die tomorrow, who's going to provide for the pet? Who's going to find the home? Who's going to make sure it gets, you know, proper vet services and all of that.
So there's a couple of ways that it can be done. One is not using a trust. One can simply say, I leave my cat to Mary and $10,000, which Mary can use to care for my cat. And if my cat dies, she can keep the balance. And you don't necessarily need a trust for that. Another is to actually set up a trust where it's going to be a little bit more broader, maybe. You can, for example, say, I want the cat to go to Mary. I want $10,000 to be kept in this trust, and John is to be the trustee and use the money for the expenses Mary may incur for the cat. Okay, so the money is not being handled by the person getting the animal. It's being handled by somebody else. And you can build on it from there any which way you want. If Mary doesn't want it, then it can go to Tom. Then Tom has first shot at the cat and the remaining money. So,
or if you know of a certain charity, and I will have clients say, I want, you know, my dog to go to this shelter run by X charity, It is a no-kill shelter, and you know, I volunteer there. I know that they will take good care, and so they will give a sum of money to that organization and direct that their pet go to that shelter.
Yeah, so, which is actually good. So that's another way of handling it. Next slide.
All right, this is one of my.
This is both of our pet peeves. We hate timeshares.
First of all, if you do not own a timeshare,
don't buy one.
Do not buy one. Do not. I mean, if you do, I'll say, do you hate your children that much?
If you have one now and you're living, get rid of it while you're living.
Well, it's better if.
It's easier.
Unless you continue to use the timeshare yourself. And I have clients who are using it all the time and they know how to make it work. You know, but oftentimes my clients are not utilizing the timeshare as much. And maybe they have their kids using it now. And I would suggest look at transferring your interest in the timeshare now to your child, children, or whoever you want to transfer it to. Timeshares are tricky. They're different in many ways. In some cases, you will actually have a deed, and to transfer, it's actually filing a new deed to transfer that property. If your timeshare is in Florida, and I'm picking on Florida because probate in Florida is very expensive, and if the timeshare is in the form of a deed, we end up having to do probate for a timeshare in Florida, and it can cost thousands of dollars. Okay, so this is why, in most cases, you can't even give away a timeshare. That's why there's advertisements on TV now. Organizations are going to help you get out of that timeshare.
I think that they're just nightmares. For the estate to get rid of it, a lot of times, first off, if the person's a Pennsylvania resident, dies in Pennsylvania, and the timeshare is out of state, you may end up dealing with two separate states, which means hiring two sets of attorney, one to handle the Pennsylvania aspect, one to handle the timeshare.
And that's if it's in a deed. Sometimes it's more like a lease. It's a lease for 99 years. And
getting a hold of people who work in these timeshare companies to assist you is traditionally been a nightmare too. I know I've done it and try to do it in some of my estates. They have very little, in most cases, value. I've had some where actually they were valuable, but 90% of them are not. And trying to give them back or abandon them opens the estate up for claims. It is, they're a pain. So if you have one and you're not using it, then go ahead and sell it. Make it easier on your kids because it's far more difficult to do it post-death than it is while the individual owns it. And again, if you don't have one, our advice is don't buy one. So
now, I guess the exception to that is if you have it, one of the Disney timeshares, they do seem to be worth money. I know the ones in Florida are by a deed. So you do have to do the probate in Florida, unless you've arranged by deed to have it transferred jointly with the kids or however you want to make sure it'll pass automatically to them on your death.
And then you also have the inherent issues that if you have a timeshare when you die and your will says, I leave everything equally, my four children, that the children, some may want it, some may not want it. And now you have all those complications too. So in any event, that's kind of been our position. I hate them. Next slide. Firearms. Whoa. Far more difficult. You have certain firearms that need to be registered under the National Firearms Act. Certain firearms do not have to be registered. Then you have issues dealing with who can own them, how can you transfer them, is the intended beneficiary legally allowed to own the weapon? Remember, if you're an ex-con with certain convictions, you cannot own a firearm. These are the types of issues crop up when we're dealing with firearms. We sometimes talk about setting things up in a gun trust. Gun trust is probably the best way, especially if you have a collection of firearms, because different firearms, and if you actually look at, I don't know whether everybody got just the PowerPoint, but they also got the handout. Mm-hmm. If you look at the handout, I go in much greater detail in the handout as the different types of firearms that have to be registered. There's certain things you cannot own in Pennsylvania, like grenades. Then that's considered a weapon. It's not what you would traditionally think of as a firearm, but it in fact is. So there's all these things dealing with weapons. Gun trusts, if there's multiple weapons, is a good solution to deal with it, because you can put somebody in charge of it and not necessarily transfer ownership to that person, but allow that person to use the firearm. You can, of course, set it up to transfer it to, assuming that they're allowed to own the firearm. But there's a lot of different things and that can be done. So I think with multiple firearms, I definitely think you should set up a gun trust.
And I should put a proviso. We apologize to those of you who do have gun collections and feel strongly about this. I have never owned a gun in my life. And fortunately, when we do have a gun issue, our former secretary's husband is a retired sheriff, and he teaches firearm safety courses. And so we just called George for help. And I know that sounds like we're being lazy, but when you don't know something, you turn to the people who do know. There are some attorneys, actually just a handful, who really specialize in this area. And so we do have names and contact info for that. But so we'll stop before we put our foot.
Well, no. I have clients who have multiple firearms who are extremely either themselves qualified to own it, extremely knowledgeable about the laws, and want to make sure it's done correctly.
And they're
very responsible people with firearms. They own gun safes in their home where they keep their firearms. So I don't have a problem. I mean, they're lawful in this country, but again, certain weapons you can have nationally have to be registered. Certain you can own in Pennsylvania, it doesn't have to be registered. It's really a specialty area.
The one thing we are concerned about is if someone lives alone and they pass away and they do have the gun collection, having a house not occupied, if we want to make sure that either those guns are removed and put into a safe environment, because I'm just always worried about, word out on the street, somebody's going to break in.
Sure.
So we just want to make sure it's kept secure.
But there is a way of handling them.
Yeah.
Next slide. Next slide. Good. Digital assets. This is something that's become more prominent in the last couple of years.
Well, and literally Pennsylvania just passed the law that will be effective in January.
Yeah. So what's a digital asset? A digital asset is an electronic record. So it can be your email account, your Facebook account, your Twitter account, your Instagram account, all those different things that's out there. There's more stuff out there than I've ever even heard of.
And your electronic banking.
Sure. Securities. Sure. So digital assets has become a big deal now, and we see it more and more. And normally, this is where the problem lies on death. Whoever is the fiduciary, not the fiduciary, The custodian of the account, which is usually, you know, whoever handles it with Facebook or AOL, that type of thing, you have a service agreement with them. And then the agreement basically says they own it, not you. And the real difficulty has been that on the death of the user, that the executor, or if the person hasn't died, their power of attorney can't get access to them, because the agreement, the service agreement, says only the user can do it. And a lot of different states have tried to deal with this particular issue. And there's really been no satisfactory resolution. So they've become dealing with this uniform law, dealing with digital assets. Pennsylvania took the good parts of what Pennsylvania thought were the good parts of this act and created their version of this digital asset law. Well, and it's a biggie, because I may need to get access to whatever, the emails for whatever purpose, or the bank accounts for whatever purpose. And it's been extremely frustrating till now.
Yeah, by way of backdrop, there really should be federal legislation, because, you know, this deals, I mean, digital is worldwide, so definitely nationally. And the federal law in the books was, I think it was in the early 1980s. So, you know, it's 40 years old. It doesn't actually meet today's
needs, because
for reasons it has not been updated. So individual states have started to pass a law for its state so that, like, an executor can gain certain access if needed, or the power of attorney, especially for someone who is ill and can't get to their records. So
next slide, by the way.
So that's why finally, and Pennsylvania is one of the last states to actually pass the law in this regard, but they have.
Yeah, and so it's a good thing. And now, if you became incapacitated, providing you have a power of attorney, and that power of attorney allows the agent under the power of attorney to get access to those digital assets, they'll be able to do so. Same thing for your executor, will be able to do so. Your guardian will be able to do so, which up to this point they haven't been able to do, because the service agreement terms didn't gave all the control to the company, but now we're reversing that.
But we have to make sure that in the will there's a power of your executor to deal with the digital assets.
The digital assets, yeah.
In the power of attorney, we do now. We've added a paragraph concerning digital assets. And, you know, you would think common sense would be an executor should be able to do that anyway, or an agent under power of attorney should be able to do that anyway. But because of problems that have arisen in the past, is why the law was passed. And as long as there's specific direction, or you may even have limitations on your executor, you may want your agent to have limitations, but whatever you spell out in terms of the control your executor can have, or your power of attorney, that is to be followed.
Next, next slide, please. So the next question is, what about my coin collection, my stamp collection, my antiques, my jewelry, those types of things? How should I deal with them? And there's a number of different ways. What's been kind of becoming more and more prominent in Pennsylvania is, in a will, putting what we call a memorandum clause. And a memorandum clause basically says, if you find attached to my will a memorandum distributing any of my personal assets, follow it. Otherwise, if there's no memorandum, just follow my will in terms of distribution of my estate. So traditionally, a person, and this is a number of years ago, would write a will, and they'd say, I leave my rings to Mary, my necklace to Jane, my coin collection to Tom, okay? And it'd be in the will. Then if they chose to change that, they had to redo the will. By using a memorandum clause, it allows the individual to write on a sheet of paper, I leave my jewelry collection, my bracelet, my necklace, coin collection, whatever, to whoever they want, sign it, date it, and attach it to the will, giving flexibility to that person to change that whenever they want without having to redo the will. So for that purpose, this memorandum clause so far has been working. It has been a good alternative to simply listing it in the will.
But I think a bigger reason is if you name it specifically in your will, then your executor after your death is required to have it formally appraised to show its value. And I find with most items, and it's usually jewelry or some of the, you know, things in the house, it has sentimental value, but it does not have a great deal of financial value. And trying to prove that, trying to pay to get it appraised, can sometimes be more expensive than what it is actually worth. Okay. Now with coins, they're tricky, and tricky in that you need to find honest people to determine actual value, and also how to dispose of the coins unless the individual beneficiary wants to hold on to them. If you yourself have certain people that you trust from your own experience, like if you are a coin collector, you know who out there is reputable. I think it is good in your memorandum or with the will to say, use so-and-so to help you sort, you know, what's the value? How do you want to sell it? How do you want to deal with it? Because I do believe coins are something, there's an awful lot of...
Yeah, difference of opinions in terms of what they're worth. Yeah.
And less than reputable.
Yeah, in some areas. I tend to agree. The thing that I find, it's happening to Dan and me, but a lot of my clients who come in, all my older clients are doing wills and stuff. We all have collections of things like Waterford.
Royal Dalton,
Hummel, Ladro, Hummels. And you want to leave them to your children, and your children absolutely want no part of them. We have suggested or asked our children that when it's our time, who wants them? And they basically run away. They absolutely want no parts of any of this. And this seems to be fairly uniform, that younger people today do not think any of these things are the least bit valuable or desirable. So, yeah, for what it's worth. Next slide. Vacation homes.
Oh, wait a minute. One of the issues, if you have something, you might have a painting or something that will have to be shipped out to somebody in California. Spell out who's going to pay for the shipment. Will it be your estate, or will it be the beneficiary who's to receive it? Because if they have to pay for the shipment, they may not want it. Or you may be putting a quite a hefty bill on your estate to ship it out. So that's something I learned the hard way that I wanted to pass on.
Okay. Next slide. Vacation homes. So that's also interesting. So I have a lot of clients, as Dana, that has vacation homes in Florida, Jersey Shore, Maryland, Delaware, things of that.
Poconos.
But I'm thinking of those that have vacation homes in other states. So what's interesting in Pennsylvania, if you own real estate in another state, Pennsylvania does not tax that for inheritance taxes. So your out-of-state real estate is not taxed by Pennsylvania. That does not mean it's not taxed in the other state. Some states like Florida, there's no inheritance tax to the children, so they're not going to pay it. But if mom and dad own their condominium in Florida, they use in the wintertime, pass away, going through probate in Florida is a nightmare. In terms of cost and time. So that presents a problem in and of itself. So in theory, you could be a situation where the parent dies, owning the condominium out of state. We probate the estate in Pennsylvania. We're going to have to do what we call an ancillary probate in that other state in order to transfer that real estate or sell that real estate. So these are problems that exist. Now, workarounds to avoid the probate situation. Well, if it's mom and dad who own it and dad dies, then there's nothing you need to be done. If the deed is tenants by the entireties, it passes to mom. If it's joint, mom owns it with child, mom dies, you don't have to do a probate because the child now owns the property.
Providing it was joint with right of survivorship.
With right of survivorship. Yeah. That's absolutely correct. So sometimes having that deed set up so that there's always somebody living when the one person dies, to avoid having to go through probate in that state, it makes a lot of sense.
Or you might set up a trust to hold the real estate.
And yes.
And that'll be a way to transfer it without probate.
And that's exactly what we do. And at least I recommend to my clients where we have the Florida property. If it's owned by mom and mom wants it to provide that on her death, all the children can use the property. I may have that transferred to a trust established in Florida, have that property in Florida moved into that trust and specify what mom wants. And we're doing that in order to avoid the probate and all those problems in Florida.
And next slide, please. Thank you.
Yeah. So if mom's living, it's called a revocable living trust, mm-hmm. and that's how it's set up. It doesn't do you any good to set up the trust inside the will, a testamentary trust, because you're back into probate at that point in time. So the revocable living trust or having a living remaining joint owner on that property. However, you know, the problems aren't as simple as that. Mom has the condominium, there are four children. All four children may not want to use it. Or four children may not want to own it. And yet, if the estate's supposed to be divided equally, you can say, well, the ones who want to use it can buy out the interest of the other ones. And then you get into arguments about value of the property. The one who's supposed to buy it out from the one who doesn't want to use it may not have the funds to purchase the other one's interest. You get into the issues of who's going to pay the bills, the maintenance, utilities, taxes, repairs, who's paying all that.
I have had so many clients who have had a vacation home that the family has used for many years, and they have wonderful memories, good times, and they want to keep that going for their kids after they die. And unfortunately, I've seen too many families after death of the parents torn apart over that vacation home. They start out, even when everybody's getting along, you know, one of the kids uses it more than the others. One is down there fixing things up. The other one's never doing anything.
Or they're fighting over which weekends or weeks they want to use it.
And so I urge my clients to think about having that vacation home sold after they've died and the proceeds distributed as they want. And by doing it that way, if one of the kids should want to purchase it from the trust, they can. They always can.
Or if they want to, they get the proceeds from its sale and they want to own their own, they can buy their own.
Yeah.
You've given them the money to do so.
So, I mean, as much as those memories are wonderful, the family will always have those memories, but don't create a situation that the kids really can't follow up on and carry out after you're gone. I mean, they love it when you're paying the bills, you're doing the maintenance. It's like when we bought our place in Ocean City, New Jersey, our kids promised to help, you know, put the furniture out on the decks.
Now, my younger daughter never promised anything.
No,
our older daughter did.
Well, anyway, when it comes time to actually doing it, you know who does it.
Sure.
They're too busy with
their own lives. We got it.
enough. So okay. Just be practical when it comes to the vacation home, as I'm saying.
Okay, so questions. Does anybody have a question we can answer?
We did get one question in the chat with specific pet care info in a will. If somebody was specifically named to take care of the pets and money was left to go to that person for the care of the pet, what happens if the person refuses to take care of the pet? Do they still have a claim to the fund set aside for the care of the pets? And can the executor hold back those funds legally?
That's where the pet trust can really help.
That's a really good question. And if money is given to someone contingent on their taking care of the pets, and they refuse to do that, then certainly the money can be withheld. And I think the executor has complete discretion to make appropriate other arrangements for the pet.
Think of it this way. If I said in my will, I leave my cat to Mary and $10,000 to care for it, Mary takes the cat and just throws the cat out and keeps the 10 grand. Well, yeah, that's not what you wanted.
That's what I'm doing.
So, but if you set up a pet trust, you could say Mary gets the cat, providing she takes care of the cat. Tom is the trustee of that pet trust, and Tom is to allocate the money as is needed, because Mary is going to give me the bill for the cat food, for the vet, things of that nature, and we'll reimburse her for it. So you can deal with it a little bit better in a pet trust if you're unsure whether the person who's going to take care of the animal is really going to do it or really, really wants the animal to begin with. So I think it can be dealt with.
Yeah.
Okay, any other questions?
That was the only one that came through the chat. If anybody else had any, they could go ahead and unmute themselves and ask one now if they wanted. But that was all.
Here's a question about something we did not cover.
This is Linda on the phone. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Okay. One of you mentioned personal needs accounts for a person in a nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
If a person is on Medicaid,
mm-hmm.
does that money have to go back to pay for their care, or can it go to whoever the will directs that it go to?
Right, that's a really good question. A personal needs account, when the individual passes away, as a general rule of thumb, if it's under a certain amount, then the family can basically keep it. In most cases, it will end up going back to the state of Pennsylvania for reimbursement for the Medicaid benefits, because you have to add the personal needs account with any other little account that the individual had.
Basically, here's the way the rule works. It says, we explain who can get the money in the personal needs account on death. The second question is, but can they keep the money on death? And the answer is, maybe, maybe not. If you've been on Medicaid, if the person's been on Medicaid who died, and the Pennsylvania has something called a state recovery, and a state recovery says on death, we, after funeral and related expenses are paid, any probate asset must be paid back to the state to offset what the payments they made on your behalf. Now, a probate asset is a solely owned asset without a beneficiary, and a personal needs account is a probate asset. But estate recovery has another rule, and it also says if the total of the probate assets is less than $2,400, the state will waive its claim for that money. So the answer is, if the personal needs account has $5,000 in it, the state's getting the $5,000. If it has $2,000 in it, the family can keep the $2,000, providing the total probate assets of the deceased is less than $2,400.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We have a follow-up to the earlier pet question, specifically without the pet trust. can the executor legally hold funds back?
Well, it depends what the will says.
If the will made the gift contingent on taking care of the pets, then the executor could withhold it.
But the problem you run into, if it says, I give Mary the cat and $10,000 to care for the cat, once the executor gives Mary the $10,000 to care for the cat, how's the executor going to get the money back?
Or if the will said, I give $10,000 and cat to Mary.
It all depends on, you know, what you're trying to do here. And if you, to me, if you really had a question about the person truly taking care of the animal, then I would do it in a pet trust. If I totally trust the person to care for the animal, then I wouldn't be as worried about setting up the trust. My feelings. Okie doke. Well, thank you all. If there's no other questions, everybody have a great Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Safe one.
Safe, healthy, and we'll talk to you next year, I guess.
And let Tara know some suggestions for topics for
next year. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Bye-bye.
Excellent presentation.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.